So, to get to the topic, beyond distraction. I don't know, are any of you beyond distraction? No, I see a lot of heads shaking. No, it's kind of humbling, isn't it? Even though many of you have been meditating for 10, 20, 30, perhaps 40 years or more, we still find that this hindrance of restlessness, this tendency of the mind to distract us, can be a real deep-rooted and chronic issue. And we need skills to work with it. We need strategies to work with it. Sometimes we can just accept that the mind wanders and thoughts arise and fall away like clouds in the sky, and we just don't get upset by it. Well, that's okay sometimes. But if we only do that and we never confront the thought patterns, sometimes that acceptance actually perpetuates the patterns of thought. And so it can be useful to have a bit of a toolkit that we've developed. And it's very interesting to me that the Buddha offered us a toolkit. There are a few discourses in the Middle Link discourses that speak very directly and specifically to the removal of distracting thoughts. And so I based this book primarily on two discourses in the Middle Link discourses, Sutta number 19, which is called Two Kinds of Thought, and Sutta number 20, which is called The Removal of Distracting Thoughts. And together, these two discourses give us a very clear, systematic, and effective methodology for working with those thoughts that are unwholesome and keep repeating. We're not trying to be thoughtless human beings. And we're not, I'm not suggesting that meditation should always be without thoughts. You know, the thoughts will fall away in deep concentration states, but we also need to be able to use our thoughts well, wisely, to apply our attention with reflection and contemplation, to be able to direct our attention skillfully, focus it on something that we're interested, look deeply and investigate the matter. But too often when we look at our thoughts and when we look at the patterns of our mind, we find that it's not wise reflection that's occurring. It's not useful investigation that's occurring, but it's some kind of proliferation or rambling thoughts that are just distracting, or they're thoughts that are rooted in unwholesome states, angry thoughts, vengeful thoughts, thoughts of worry, thoughts of fear, thoughts of rumination, thoughts of trying to control situations, trying to fantasizing about pleasant experiences, entertaining ourselves with those kinds of fantasies, all of which disconnect us from the vividness of present experience. And so these strategies can become very useful for meditators who want to develop their skills, their meditator's toolkit, so to speak. And in the initial guided meditation of this sitting group, I guided you through all these strategies very briefly. Those of you that are familiar with it probably were aware of what I was doing and may even have been able to count which the strategies were. But I want to speak a bit to them and then invite questions on the subject of how to work with thoughts. The first step comes before any of the official five strategies that are offered in the discourse on the removal of distracting thoughts. And the first step is to be mindful that thinking is happening and to know that a thought is a discrete mental event. Because when we're looking at it as a mental event, we are no longer entangled in the content. If we're thinking about a dinosaur, we can be sure that that dinosaur is not in the room with us, right? But we can still think about a dinosaur. But often when we look at the thoughts in our mind, it's as though we believe that they're real. We're reacting to them with emotions. We're getting entangled with them. We're planning how we're going to respond to them as though they are actually in the room with us, as though they're real. We've forgotten that they're discrete mental events. They're thoughts that arise in the mind. And so I like to remind myself that the thought of a dinosaur is not a dinosaur. And I like that one because I've never seen a real dinosaur. So there's no possibility that it could be real. And it really reminds me that we conjure up these worlds of fantasy and imagination, often driven by fear or by anger or by lust or by some kind of just preoccupation with who I am, the story of self, because so many thoughts embellish this story of self, this identity of who we are. So first, we are simply mindful of thoughts. And, you know, a good deal of our thoughts need nothing more for them to fall away. Just simply, this is a thought arising in the mind. That's all. We're mindful, we're present, we know what it is, and we can come back to whatever our chosen meditation may be. Perhaps we're doing mindfulness with breathing or mindfulness of the body practice. So I wouldn't, if the first step is to just be mindful of what's happening. And that comes even before these five strategies. And I actually find that takes care of most of them. But there are sometimes certain sticky thoughts, very habitual patterns that we've practiced for a long time, or maybe they're not practiced for a long time, but for some reason they really trigger us strongly and they're infused with defilements. Maybe they're rooted in anger. Maybe they're rooted in greed. Maybe they're rooted in self-interest. And these thoughts are the kind of thoughts that we might then apply the five strategies to. And the first strategy is replacing. We replace an unwholesome thought with a wholesome one, which implies we first have to notice if that habitual thought is wholesome or unwholesome. And then we are now going to work with a set of strategies to overcome the unwholesome thoughts and they're the roots of those patterns. So the first is to replace, and the image that's used, the simile, is of a block of wood that has a peg in it. And to remove the peg, to dislodge the peg, we use a smaller peg and use the smaller peg to knock out that larger peg. But the small peg doesn't stay stuck in the block of wood because it's smaller. So we let go of a thought that's maybe deeply rooted in a defilement, and we replace it with a wholesome alternative. For example, we let go of a thought of anger and we replace it with a thought of loving kindness. We let go of a thought of fear and replace it with a thought that instills faith and confidence. We let go of a thought of the desire to possess something or get it, you know, whatever it might be. And we replace it with a reflection on impermanence. So we shift our thoughts from one to another. This reminds us we are not stuck in those thoughts. And this replacement thought, the wholesome thought, doesn't get stuck in our minds. So it serves the purpose of dislodging the unwholesome pattern. And then we go back to sitting and breathing or whatever our meditation practice might be. We can do this in meditation, but we can also apply these strategies in relationships, in conversations, in daily activities, in all sorts of things where we find the mind distracted. Sometimes we're engaged in a project and we're trying to accomplish something. And maybe the project isn't really quite capturing our interest. Like maybe we're trying to clean the house or organize our desk or do something there where we find ourselves always distracted from it. Well, we might need to work with the distraction in while engaged in that activity, bring mindfulness to the distraction, and then start to work with the feelings and replace them with something more wholesome, more useful. And again, each of the strategies works for some subset of thoughts on some occasions. But there are also times when they repeat. And so we end up working through this sequence of strategies only on those thoughts that keep repeating. And the next step, if those patterns and distracting thoughts still arise, is after replacing them and the mind doesn't settle back with its meditation subject or our attention doesn't settle back with the task at hand, then we might need to consider the danger, examine the danger in those thoughts or in that mental state that's being reinforced by that thought pattern. And the basic question I ask myself is, where is it leading and do I want to go there? Where is it leading and do I want to go there? And if it's an unwholesome thought, if it's a thought of anger, for example, we know where it's going and we don't want to go there. So if it's a thought of lust, if it's a thought of just delusion and arrogance or fear, or rumination or worry, you know, we don't really want to live with that as the dominant thought, otherwise, because it's unwholesome. So we're asking ourselves, if we were to continue this thought, where is it going to lead? What is it developing within my own mind? Is it the pattern that I want to nourish? And you're probably familiar with the quote from one of these discourses that says, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of one's mind. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, one has abandoned the thought of renunciation in order to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And the mind inclines towards thoughts of sensual desire. So we know that whatever thoughts we frequently think, ponder upon, that becomes our habit of mind. And when we reflect upon those dangers, do I want to reinforce this in my mind? Very often we say, no, I really don't. This is a painful state. This is a dangerous state to nourish. This is not going to support my spiritual path. And so that builds a kind of dispassion towards the thought and helps us to let go of it. But sometimes our thought, those habitual patterns just arise again. So what do? The next step is called to ignore it or to forget it. Or to withdraw our attention from it, to in some way avoid that thought. And the simile that's used is of somebody who has the capacity to see, good eyesight, they just choose to turn away and don't look at something. And although that doesn't sound like a very mindful activity, because so much of our mindfulness practice encourages us to look very deeply and closely at what's actually happening, it is indeed a powerful capacity that we have, is to not only look towards something, but to also choose to not look at it. Because there are times when just even noticing something with our attention feeds it. So we need the ability to just withdraw our attention from it. This is especially helpful when we're working with thoughts that are building a kind of grudge about something that happened in the past, or around something. Maybe we were betrayed, maybe we were hurt, maybe somebody conned us or took advantage of us, and we've already thought about it enough to, recognize our vulnerabilities or the mistakes or the way that we played a role in it. We've already learned what we needed to learn from it. But sometimes the humiliation or the pain of the experience keeps those thoughts coming around and around, hurting nobody but ourselves. And it can build a grudge. It can build hatred and hostility. It can build a lack of trust with anybody else. There's these kinds of thoughts. Sometimes the best thing to do is to just not think it anymore, to turn our attention away from it. And I don't think this should be the first strategy, or we'd never learn anything. But I think we all can probably think of some instance at some point in our lives when we spent a little too much time dwelling on something. We'd already learned the lesson, and every further moment we spent dwelling that with it was doing nothing but hurting our own state of mind. So we can withdraw our attention from it. We can avoid thinking about it. But, you know, this doesn't always work. And of course, sometimes we can't just turn away from it because we need to actually understand the cause for that proliferation of thought. So whereas that strategy two asks for a kind of examination and investigation of the danger, strategy four asks us to look at the causal dynamics. So I ask the question with strategy two, where is this going and do I want to go there? But I ask the question with strategy four, this investigative component, where did this come from? How did this arise? And so we might look at and investigate and kind of untangle the various threads that are keeping that pattern in place. The emotions, the feelings. What's the relationship between the thoughts, the emotions, the feelings, the mental states? How do they change? Is it one thing or is it many things all combined together that keep re-triggering the experience of that rumination or those repeating thoughts? So we kind of look deeply. We look at what's going on there. And very often, as we look at the underlying, the undercurrents of those thoughts, we see that they are entangled with a construction of self. And that's the place. It's deep in the experience when we get to some of the causal connections that keep feeding and keep re-energizing unwholesome thought patterns, instead of dealing at the surface of the content, or even the relationship of the feeling and the mental state and the content. We start to look very deeply at what the undercurrents are, and that's where the stillness comes. The language in the discourse is stilling the thought formations of those thoughts. So we look deeply. And we bring in calmness and clarity and loosen the grip of that attachment to that version of the self story. Because underneath most, if not all, of our distracting thoughts is some sense of a particular self story. Can we let go of that too? By this point, we're at strategy four. Virtually all of our distracting thoughts will have been resolved somewhere along the way. We certainly don't need to look at the deep roots of causal formations of every thought that arises in our meditation. Oh my goodness, the thought of that is just, who would meditate? It would be exhausting. We do nothing but investigate and thinking. This kind of meditative investigation is brief, a few seconds, that's it. It's more about looking with curiosity. Instead of at the thought as an object, we're now looking at the causal relationships that gave rise to it. We're looking at where it gets its fuel. So most thoughts will have already fallen away and the mind will be settling on either in daily life, on the task that we're trying to engage in or the project we're working with, or on in meditation, on the settling our attention with our meditation subject. But every once in a while, there's a particularly strong thought. Oh my goodness, it's amazing. And sometimes even after we have replaced it and used antidotes and used seen the danger and really been very clear about not wanting to develop that in our minds. And we've been able to pull our attention away, but only for a moment, and we're right back pulled like magnet, right back into the swirl of those proliferating unwholesome thoughts. And then we've investigated and we understand it. We see it. Oh, we'd be so clear. We could all give a Dharma talk about how the interaction of this thought and this feeling and how it all works and what the root causes are. You know, we get it. We know it. We understand the dynamic, but sometimes we're still stuck in the sense that we still lean into that thought. And it still arises and we give it space in our mind. So the final strategy is a strategy that we can use only when we are really clear, when there's wisdom. It does not come out of aversion or out of anger. There's no self-judgment here. It's a clear discernment. And a discernment that brings a resolve and determination to not think that thought again, to not cultivate that defilement in our own minds, to not give it any space or time. We can only do this final kind of effortful resolve and determination, what I call the strategy of saying no and meaning it. We can only do it when there's no aversion at all in the mind, when it's based truly on this understanding that's developed through the sequence of the previous strategies. So we develop these skills, these strategies, these abilities of mind, not only to understand what's happening, but to have a very clear relationship. Now we're seeing just this energy pattern of that this diluted energy pattern, and we can say no to it. We're not taking it personally anymore because we've already investigated it to its roots in self-construction. So we're not taking it personally. We're not identified with it. So we can say no. The image that's used, the simile that's used in the sutta is of a strong man who might beat down a weaker man by the head or shoulders. You know, like, can you imagine that strength? And most Westerners think, oh, what a horrible image. It's so violent. But I like the image because it reminds us that our virtues, our resolve, our determination to free the mind is stronger than our defilements. And we're coming to meet that residue of the defilement that keeps us being pulled into those distracting thoughts. We're coming to it from a strength of the purity of our mind, of our investigation, of our virtues. So this brings us through the five strategies with the preparation of being mindful of the thought as a thought. And these are the steps that the Buddha gave us to work with various distracting thoughts. And then the conclusion to this discourse on the removal of distracting thoughts, he says, then one will think whatever thought one wishes to think, and one will not think any thought one does not wish to think. It's quite a profound result of training the mind to work with distracting thoughts. Wouldn't it be nice to live a day, even let alone a lifetime or a year or years in our lives, even just one day, and to only think thoughts you want to think, not think any thought you don't want to think? To me, that's very profound, because you're aware of how much suffering comes by the thoughts that we think ourselves. So this requires, of course, a lot of wisdom and a development of samadhi, of stability of mind. There's an intertwining in this practice of concentration and wisdom. And it leads then to the possibility, when we have removed distracting thoughts from our mind, it leads to the experience of deep concentration. Because if we have removed distraction, then what's the obstacle to jhana or deep concentration? There really isn't any. So this can be a very supportive sequence for training the mind to remove the distractions to strengthen our concentration. But you can think a little more about this. And if we have removed distraction and seen those very roots, we have also ended the fetter of restlessness, uprooted craving and conceit. Because those defilements, they thrive in distracting thoughts. And we've taken away the environment in which those defilements could develop. So we gain insight into the workings of restlessness as a fetter, into the workings of craving and conceit, and are primed for liberating insight. So by working with these two suttas, I think we actually have an interesting meditation plan. And it's a plan for confronting those obstacles, not only in sitting meditation, but it's very applicable to the activities in daily life. Because, you know, sometimes the biggest problem for doing some of the things we want to do in our own lives are the distractions in our own minds. So I hope this gives you an overview of what these strategies are. The book that I wrote is a very accessible book with lots of exercises, to exercise boxes, to explore ways to apply this in your daily activities, as well as your meditation. Every chapter has numerous boxes. So if you want to work with this, then you can explore the book, or you can join that online course I mentioned at the beginning, that is going to go through this with chapter by chapter, with lots of guided meditations and recorded lectures and a lot of additional resources. So anyway, that was my Dharma talk on this theme. And we have a few minutes left. I'd like to see if you have any comments, questions, and it's something for discussion. Let's see. Let's take Patty first and then Vita.
Thank you so much, Shaila. That was terrific. I'm enjoying the book. I'm reading it with a group of other Sangha members together, and that was a wonderful summary. My one question has to do with distinguishing wholesome from unwholesome thoughts. And what helped me was when it's not strongly unwholesome, it's only a distraction in that it's taking me away from the present moment. It's unwholesome and then I'm missing now by indulging that thought. And my thought is usually planning. And if I can recognize there I'm planning again, I'm missing what's happening now, I can come back. But it doesn't feel unwholesome in any way other than it's taking me away from now. When I say, where's it leading me and do I want to go there? It's leading me away from now and I don't want to go there, but I don't see any long-term problems with that kind of unwholesome thought.
Yeah, the long-term problem, but the process you're engaged in is lovely. It's because you're recognizing what it is. You're asking the question, you know, do I want to go there? And you're saying, no. I mean, my mindfulness is about connecting with the experience that we're having. But part of the relationship to this planning is that we're living in a way in a fantasy. And you know that, you sense that. So you're seeing the danger of living in a fantasy of a plan. And often then when you're actually doing the activity that you planned before, you're planning something else. Maybe how to describe it to somebody or how to have the experience again. If we keep engaging in planning, we live disconnected from life. And we can't plan the things that really matter. You know, insight. We can't plan when we're going to have an insight. They only happen in present experience, you know, in the encounter with now. We can't plan awakening. It's never going to happen in a future moment. It's always going to be an encounter of letting go in the now. So we're disempowering ourselves from the things that actually matter the most. We can't plan when we're going to love, how we're going to meet somebody heart to heart. So the loss is enormous, even though there's the delusion in planning that makes us feel like it's a gain. The loss of what's most of the things that are so important. It's so by reflecting on it, you build the dispassion. You'll find that there's less satisfaction in gratification and planning, and more interest in being present. But nevertheless, this, for example, isn't the kind of pattern that I would march through all of them and say no to, you know, with any strong way, because as you say, it doesn't have the level of toxicity that, say, a thought of revenge might have. So we work slightly differently, but I would definitely put a chronic planning fantasy in the unwholesome category, smack dab in the middle of that unwholesome strategy, because it perpetuates restlessness. It keeps the identity of self in the controller position, and it eliminates the possibility of mindfulness, concentration, insight, and liberation. And anything that eliminates all of those things, which I value so much, is of great concern to me. Thank you. It's a really great question. And this planning, the proliferation around planning is often encouraged in our culture. So I really appreciate that you catch it and that you caught it and that you're highlighting it in your practice.
Thank you.
Thank you. Peter, go ahead.
Thank you. Really interesting. Really useful. Thank you. I have two quick questions. One quick question and one question. What are the Sutta numbers again?
19 and 20 in the Middle Link Discourses.
19 and 20 in the middle?
Yeah. You also might want to read 18. It relates to the proliferation of thoughts. But the book was based primarily on 19 and 20.
Thank you. Would you just say a little bit more about the number four, causal dynamics?
The language in the sutta is stilling the thought formations of those thoughts. But it's really about investigating, but not about a kind of, I'm going to get to the bottom of like, not looking for blame, not trying to go to what happened in early childhood that has created that conditioning. Now, of course, there are things from our past that have created our conditioning. There's no doubt about those kinds of experiences, various kinds of experiences from our past, playing a significant role in the dynamics that we each experience moment by moment. But what we're looking at is the entanglement right now. What's making that thought re-arise now? And sometimes we'll see different triggers. Sometimes we'll see different associations with past events. But very often, it's going to touch some aspect of who we take ourselves to be. It's going to be those repeating thoughts are basically repeating the story of self. So whenever I've gotten to the point in the sequence where I have to start to look deeply, I first untangle the thought and the changing thoughts. So there's never just one thought. It's like a developmental thought, even planning, like, let yourself plan. I don't have a problem with that once, twice, three times, maybe. But you know, how many times are you going to play on it with a different what if this, then what if that? And then at some point, it's really no longer any useful planning. For example, it's just a kind of a much more controlling or worry or something. So, so you can look at the different thoughts, and then we know thoughts are changing. And the emotions and feelings that arise in those changing thoughts are also changing. So what am I taking? What's so significant that I keep dwelling in this world of changing thoughts and feelings rather than the world that I'm experiencing in this body in this moment? So that helps to disentangle the events of thinking and feeling from the story and the narrative. And then as I look more deeply, it really almost always settles into some sense of self. So I have to actually watch there the constructing of self through those thoughts. See them, see how it plays out, and perhaps pose the question, who would I be without that thought? And usually it's an experience then of letting go in peace, because I've given myself produced the opportunity to not be stuck in that pattern anymore. So this investigation is basically an application of curiosity. You're not really figuring it out intellectually. You're not like diagramming it. You're not thinking in the same way we think about things in the world. We're looking at what's occurring with curiosity to understand the causes. That's all.
It feels like it could take the whole sit.
Not more than 2 minutes, preferably 10 seconds.
Helpful. Thank you.
No meditative investigation should take more than a few seconds, maximum a minute or two.
Thank you.
And that's indulging. That's indulging a little bit. If you go over a minute, it's pretty indulging, because it's just seeing with curiosity to understand relationships, the triggers, the relationships of things, the interactions of things. And that we have to see as it occurs in the present moment. That's why it's not, if we are thinking about it for more than a few seconds, we've probably lost the curiosity and are embellishing the story.
Thank you so much. Really, really, really useful.
Great. Thank you.